Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. How did a group of intellectually challenged men, disabled men from Texas, end up working in an Iowa turkey processing center where they were abused, exploited, and kept in squalor? It's a story that's told in a new book, The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland, written by New York Times reporter and columnist Dan Barry. And Dan, welcome to The Source.
Thanks very much, David.
Our phone lines are open. If you've got a question or a comment about this amazing story, call in 210-614-8980. Dan, there's a lot to tell here just to get people up to speed about what the story is. So how do you, what's your capitalization? How do you explain it?
Sure. Back in the late 60s and early 70s, Texas was moving toward deinstitutionalization. And they wanted to free up beds, and they also wanted these young men with intellectual disability to become taxpayers, quite frankly. And so Texas made an arrangement with a rancher in Goldthwaite to take several of these men from state schools in Texas and teach them a skill, and that skill was effectively to work with turkeys. And so it was very popular at the time, and the owner, T.H. Johnson, was declared Employer of the Year by an association that represented disability rights back in 1968. And then after a couple of years, they contracted with turkey plants around the country in Illinois and South Carolina, and specifically Iowa, to take, 20, 30, 40, 50 of the men and have them live near turkey plants and work eviscerating turkeys, unloading turkeys from the trucks, defeathering, all the lousy jobs in, a difficult workplace.
And in this process, they were working. How much were they paid?
Right. So in 1974, when this program began, say, in Adelissa, Iowa, so there was about 40 or 50 men who went to Adelissa, Iowa, in eastern Iowa. They were paid at that time $65 a month plus room and board in an old schoolhouse that was kind of tricked out into a dormitory, plus what they called in-kind services, which meant weekly trips maybe to the Walmart or a camping trip or a visit to an amusement park. So they were paid $65 a month in 1974. And in 2009, when this arrangement was exposed, they were still making $65 a month.
And they were found to be living in what kind of conditions?
In the beginning, in 1974, this schoolhouse was, pretty good. You and I might not want to live there, but it wasn't squalid, and there was plenty of food, and there was a pool table and exercise equipment. It was sort of like a college dorm, low rent. But over the years, the building, which was many generations old, began to fall into disrepair, so that by 2007, 8, and 2009, it was cockroach-infested, vermin-infested, and holes in the ceilings, and the windows were boarded up with board, and it was not a pleasant place to live. It was horrible.
And the men, how were their medical treatment?
Not very good. Toward the end, now these men began working at this plant, say in 1974. They were in their 20s and maybe in their 30s. So after 25, 35 years, now they're in their 50s, 60s, even their 70s, and they've been doing a lousy job 5 days a week for many years, a very repetitive job, eviscerating turkeys and standing in an assembly line. And so now their hands are constricted from doing the same repetitive chores. Their teeth are not in good condition. Their legs are not in good condition. They have fungus growing up the sides of their legs. So I would say they were in advanced stages of neglect.
And were they kept in a nurturing environment? Were they subjected to a lot of psychological abuse?
Again, it devolved. So in the beginning, in the early 1970s, the people who ran this operation, two men who owned a company called Henry's Turkey Service, you could argue were the surrogate fathers to these men. They had effectively been abandoned at these state schools, and now they're out in the world, in some respect, under the guidance of these two men. But as the years went by, all sorts of things happened, and the care declined, and it wasn't pretty toward the end.
Weren't they berated if they didn't do enough turkeys at the end of the day?
Absolutely. So the whole business model depended on the numbers of turkeys that were eviscerated. So there was a lot of pressure on these men to do as many in a day as they could, and that could be 10, 15, even 20,000 turkeys a day. And so toward the end, if they did not hit their numbers, or if they were thought to have not worked hard enough, which was quite subjective, quite frankly, they were denied certain things. First of all, they had no basic rights to begin with, if you think about it. They couldn't say, hey, I don't feel like going to work today, or hey, you know, I'd like to do a different job, or I'd like to live somewhere else. So they were denied those basic rights that you and I enjoy. But as they worked, as the years went by, rather, if they didn't hit those numbers, as I said, they would be denied, say, getting out at the mini-mart to go buy a Mountain Dew or a piece of beef jerky. They would go home, and they wouldn't be allowed to watch television, or they'd have to go to bed early, or they might get kicked in the butt, or they might get slapped upside the head, or they might be told to carry weights around the yard as a form of punishment. And that's the kind of abuse that was happening toward the end.
There was one of these men, he said he had enough, he rebelled, he tried to run away. What's that story?
His name was Alfred Busby, and in about 1986, he did something that you shouldn't do at a place that's dealing with food or a meat plant. People are unclear on what exactly he did, but when they came back to the schoolhouse that night, he was punished. He was told, no television, go right to your room. And we have to remember that this man was now in his late 30s, early 40s. You wouldn't say that to an adult who was non-disabled. And so he was mortified, and he stewed overnight. And in the morning, he ran away in a light jacket. And this was unfortunate because it was January in Iowa, and it was below zero outside. And so he disappeared into the night, and they couldn't find him for a few months, and some people just assumed that he had hitchhiked his way somehow back to Texas. But it was in the spring thaw that a farmer was going out to check his fields, and he saw what appeared to be a scarecrow at a fence row, and unfortunately it was Alfred Busby.
The book is The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland. We're talking with the author, Dan Barry. He's a reporter and a columnist for the New York Times. So how does the United States, or Texas, how do we protect our most vulnerable adults? What does this discovery about these men working under these conditions say about how we value the lives of the disabled, how we protect their civil rights? There's still an ongoing controversy here in Texas about our state-supported living centers, which is supposed to be caring for the intellectually disabled in Texas, and how it doesn't comply with the civil rights. And they have been sued by the federal government, and they're not in compliance. And this has been going on for over 5 years now. We'd like to hear your stories, or about how the working involved, giving work to these individuals. Sometimes they're proud of the work. They want to be paid. They want to contribute, but it doesn't always go according to plan. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book, The Boys in a Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland, with the author, Dan Barry, and he is a New York Times columnist and writer, reporter. And we're talking about how we protect these adults. They have low IQs, they're intellectually disabled. We can put these people to work, you know, like they did here, but how do we make sure that they are going to be protected and not exploited? So, Dan, the title, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland, tell me about that.
Sure. I would say that the servitude occurred in Texas initially, and then out in Atlanta, Iowa. As I said, these men were being paid $65 a month, effectively, and they had no basic rights, okay? And if they didn't work hard enough, they were punished. That would be the servitude component. I don't think anyone would dispute that. The salvation is that in 2009, finally, after a lot of tips being ignored or not followed up on, including an investigative piece in the Des Moines Register, the model was breaking down. One of the owners had passed away, and the other was ready to retire, but so too were these men. These men were in their 60s and 70s and doing this difficult job. And a relative was called and said, you know, Keith is going to go back to a nursing home in Texas. And the relative said, well, he's been working for you for 30-odd years. How much money does he have saved up? And the answer was $86. And this blew the top of her head off, and she called everybody she could in the state of Iowa, including an investigative reporter at the Des Moines Register, and the garbage can was tipped over. Now, since then, there were 32 men who wound up being part of a class action suit filed by the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission and a Dallas attorney for the EEOC named Robert Canino. He became their champion. He won a verdict for them. It wound up being a couple of million dollars. And now, of those 32 men, four have since passed away, so they had very little freedom after having endured what they did. Then there's several men living in nursing homes and other situations in and around Texas, a couple who are living with family. And most of the men are living in Waterloo, Iowa, in suburban homes, and they have choice in life. They've been denied choice in life. They now, you know, if they want to work, they work. If they don't want to work, they don't. They have girlfriends. They go fishing. They do whatever they want. They do what you and I would do in a normal course of the day.
Where were their relatives from the get-go? They just figured that they were being taken care of and they didn't visit or inquire?
Well, it's complicated. You know, if we're talking about these 32 men, they each, so that means there are 32 individual stories. So in some cases, the family members stayed very much a part in these men's lives. They would come home for a summer vacation, or they'd come home for Christmas, and they'd receive birthday gifts and the like. But a lot of the men, I would say most of the men, were effectively dropped off at the gates of the state schools and then effectively abandoned by their families. And it could be for, you know, reasons that the families didn't have the emotional wherewithal or the financial wherewithal. Who knows what it was, but many of these men did not have family members very active in their lives. So that's why there was that gap there.
A lot of people noted that the men did not complain about their conditions and how they were being treated.
Mm-hmm. And I puzzled about that, David, because, you know, the men, many of the men have are, you know, quite articulate in their own way. And an expert finally explained to me, you know, the reason they didn't complain, and that's a cop-out, right? Oh, the men didn't complain, so how are we supposed to know? The men didn't complain because they hadn't known any better, if you think about it. They're in state schools in Texas, okay? They're removed from those state schools, and they go to
the term state schools is very generous, don't you think?
Yes, but isn't that the term in Texas?
It was, right? Yes.
Oh, have they done away with it?
Well, yeah, now it's state-supported living centers.
Right. So back then they were called state schools. There's all sorts of reasons why they were called that. But, it, you know, they were not the best situations for these men. And so that's what they had known. So many of them were left at the gates by their families. They know an institutional setting in Texas in the mid-1960s. And then they go to this ranch. To them, the ranch was like Nirvana. Because they hadn't known any better. And then they go to this bunkhouse in Iowa. And, you know, even though they endured all sorts of abuse and mistreatment and denial of rights, you know what? It wasn't the state school.
Right. They were still outside. They were still able to exert some sort of independence or individuality. But in the town that they were in, you know, Adelisa, and how do they impact the town?
You know, when they first arrived, the town didn't know what to make of them. The town is so small that when 50 men arrived in town to live in this bunkhouse, this old schoolhouse, the town's population increased by like 25%. It's only a town of a couple of hundred people. And so they kept their distance at first, but gradually the men became integral in the community. They were accepted at the churches. They were accepted at the tavern when they'd go down there on a Friday night to have a root beer or a beer. They were featured in the annual parade. So there was kind of an embrace by the town.
So the men dressed up as clowns in the parade, right?
Yeah, and that's complicated too, right? Because, you know, on the one hand, you look at those photographs of the men dressed as clowns and you think, okay, they're being made fun of. And that might be the case, quite frankly. But on the other hand, the woman who made those clown outfits, you know, an older woman, really was kind of a mother figure to these men, and she dressed up as a clown as well. So it was complicated. It depended on how you looked at it. Those photographs, though, I will say, are quite disturbing to see.
The issue of pay is also complicated, particularly not just isolated to the boys in the bunkhouse, but also in general, as we talk about our intellectually disabled community and how they do work. Many of them do work. If they're in institutions, they frequently find piece work that they can do, and they're not paid minimum wage.
No, and there's a reason for that. There's a federal law that was passed in the late 1930s, and the idea was to encourage the hiring of people with disability and, you know, disabled war veterans from World War I. I think that was part of the impetus. And the argument is that David is non-disabled. He works at 100% capacity. Dan has intellectual disability. He can only do about 65% of what David does. Therefore, Dan should get paid 65% of what David does. That sounds okay, fair. You may take issue with it. But what happened, at least in this case with Henry's Turkey Service, that was abused, that was exploited. That was not, you know, they came up with all these calculations that were really not adhered to, and the men were just simply given $65 a month.
Some people say that the work gave these men meaning in their life. They wanted to contribute. They were happy to be, they were proud of what they did.
You know, I suppose that's true. I think they did take great pride in what they did, and certainly at the end of this journey, they were training non-disabled men how to do their jobs. They were that good. But I would say to you that the men were never given a choice of doing something else. They could have done something much better, that paid better, that didn't require them to be covered in turkey guts and blood every day. And so that's part of what the problem was here. They were denied the option of choosing something else. If you had an option not to work eviscerating turkeys 5 days a week for 35 years, you may very well take that option.
Well, these men had civil rights. They have civil rights, and those rights included not to be abused or exploited, and that seems to be what was happening to them, that they should have, or someone who had guardianship over them should have been looking out for their best interest.
Right, and that didn't happen. I often think of it as these men living in amber, okay? So they're there in 1974, they're there in 2009. Nothing effectively has changed except the place has declined in livability, right? Outside of that, outside of Adelissa, people with intellectual disability are benefiting from all sorts of laws. The Americans with Disabilities Act is really championing the rights and declaring the rights and fairly so, of people with disability. These men were denied that. They had civil rights. They were just not available to them.
So looking at the boys in the bunkhouse and widening out the lens here, what's the takeaway about this book and what you write about and America and those who have intellectual disabilities?
Well, first of all, I think that otherness still exists. There's an otherness, a segregation that exists between the non-disabled and people with disability, and that has to change. They have to, you know, people with disability are a part of us. They're in our community. They should be embraced, okay? And secondly, I think we have to remain vigilant for those among us who are vulnerable. We can't just assume always that someone else is taking care of them. Oh, the government has taken care of that. I think in Adelissa, you would see Gene Berg or Henry Wilkins, and his teeth would be messed up and his hands would be crooked and he'd be walking funny. And you wouldn't think anything of it, perhaps, because you say, oh, well, the government's taking care of it. I think this part of the story, part of the message of the book, rather, is to remain vigilant for people among us who are vulnerable. We are, in fact, our brothers and sisters keepers, I think.
90% is the estimated of unemployment is the that's estimated for this community. And that doesn't have to be 90%.
No, not at all. And, you know, these men, they're varying levels of ability.
And it's organizations that will provide training and placement.
Absolutely right. And that's why the sheltered workshop model is being challenged by the Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice around the country, because that model effectively was became another form of segregation. People in sheltered workshops are not, you know, working at TJ Maxx in the mall, or they're not working at the Burger King, and they're not taking jobs that might challenge their skills and improve their skills. And so the Department of Justice has taken a hard look at that and is making it very, very difficult for that model to continue.
And when you talk to the boys in the bunkhouse, the guys who are still around, you ask them about if they want some turkey, they don't want to have turkey. They don't have no appetite for turkey.
No, they love ice cream, many of the guys. They love ice cream.
Right.
And they get help in trying to balance their diet. But right. One thing that is not part of that diet, turkey.
Dan Barry is a reporter, columnist for the New York Times. Thank you so much. The book is The Boys in a Bunkhouse.